Welcome to the slaughter. What are you going to do? What will be your epitaph when we get done with you? Are you going to cry for your mama? Are you going to have a good time? Are you going to be a Mohab when it's your turn to die? Don't get pretty crazy.
Hello everyone, and welcome to the fourth installment of Fourth Wall Podcast Famous Firsts. I'm Freddie.
And I'm Mark.
And today we're going to be talking about Grant Morrison's work for the magazine Near Myths and Brian Michael Bendis's Fire. So first up, we're going to be talking about Grant Morrison's Abstract Beginnings in Near Myths. So in Near Myths, there are four stories that Mr. Morrison got to tell. It was a very short-lived magazine. It was edited by Brian Talbot, who you might know from doing some artwork in Sandman or Fables. Do you know any other things that they would know Mr. Talbot for, Art?
Nope.
Well, Sandman, Fables, and various other things. But Grant Morrison's stories in Near Myths include Time is a Four-Letter Word, Gideon Stargrave, Parts 1 and 2, and The Checkmate Man, which ends on a to-be-concluded in issue number 6 of Near Myths, which was never to be because after issue number 5, the series was canceled because of money. So we'll never know what happened. And also, there was supposed to be some more Gideon Stargrave, too, but who knows. I don't think that ever saw the light of day either. So, yeah, well, I guess we'll start from the first story. Time is a four-letter word. First thing that I know of that Grant Morrison ever wrote. And Drew, I might add, both the books we're talking about this month, Brian Michael Bendis and Grant Morrison both wrote and drew their books. So I guess all you kids out there that want to be comic creators, learn to draw, because that seems to be a good way to get in. And also, if you want to be like Grant Morrison, make your shit make no sense at all. Because I didn't. Did any of this? The time. Okay, some of them did make sense. I'll give him something. Like the last one. What was that one called?
Checkmate Man.
Checkmate Man. I followed. Now the first one. Time is a four-letter word. Please explain to me what the hell happened in this art, because I don't know.
You're kidding, right? Because. Like, I'm flipping through right now, and I'm just going, like, I don't know where they are. I don't know what time they are. They're dealing with magic or some sorts.
Yes.
They're talking about...
The lettering of the title is very reminiscent of Clockwork Orange. So that's... I got that reference.
I got that. It's in black and white. I guess they couldn't afford color.
It's very 80s looking.
Yes. Which is kind of surprising, because I thought it was 1970-something.
they go to Stonehenge at the end of it. It's only, what is it, like 5 pages long?
Yeah.
Yeah, this was a magazine, and it was put out in Scotland, is that right?
Yeah.
And it featured work of up-and-coming artists and writers in Scotland, and Grant Morrison was one of them. He just happened to go to, I think the story is he went to a convention, and he had some of the like artwork that he had done for these stories. And he showed it to these guys that were getting ready to put out this magazine, and they gave him money. And he's like, holy shit, you can make money doing this kind of stuff. And anyway, getting back to this story, Time is a Four-Letter Word, there's two main characters in it, a scantily clad girl and a scantily clad man, and they're weaving time, and it's very Grant Morrison-y. He didn't start out writing, you know, stories like Owly or anything like that.
But yeah, I mean, doing this British, no, I think the Scotland thing is where Grant was actually born. We got a little confused right there. He must have went to wherever the British Near Myths organization was had. But I think the amazing thing is just that he was 17 doing these. I mean, like, and
really?
Yeah, so, like, when you're reading these, especially the first one, because the first one is just kind of, like, how we talk about how this is crazy Grant Morrison, I'm like, yeah, but this is 17-year-old, quote-unquote, crazy Grant Morrison, so it's like, And he was coming up with these concepts right then and there that even we can't even wrap our heads around. Back when he was just a young lad, which is kind of amazing in and of itself.
Yes. Now, the second story, Gideon Stargrave, I definitely enjoyed more. It's longer. It's actually three-part. The first part is in Near Myths number 3, and the second and third part is in Near Myths number 4. And you can find back issues of the magazine on eBay. I just checked prior to us recording this, and I think issue number 5 and issue number 1 are both up there, and they're not expensive. If these sound interesting to you, check it out. But anyways, Gideon Stargrave, if you like Buckaroo Banzai, I don't know what else to combine that with. Buckaroo Banzai meets fucking Ragnarok, I guess.
Ragnarok.
That's what the whole thing is. I mean, it's a very essential, or not essential, what's the word I'm looking for? Typical. Yeah, that's it. It's a very typical Grant Morrison, where the story is really simple. It's basically of Gideon Stargrave. There's this guy. He meets up with this girl. They're being pursued. The guy's having to, like, kill off these priests and stuff. And they're being pursued by the Pope? Isn't it the Pope that's after him?
I think it is the Pope. Yeah, Vatican Conspiracy, the first one.
Yeah. And she ends up getting captured. He goes in to save her and then saves the day in the end. Like, that's pretty much it. But it's typical Grant Morrison in the fact that it's told in the most convoluted way possible, which...
I don't think it's that convoluted. Well, I mean, more so than the first thing I've read. Like, when you read the first Mirror Moves, you're just like, where am I?
Yeah.
And what am I on? Like, when you read this Gideon Stargrave stuff, it's like, he kind of knew that he was doing it in the genre. He was doing something like British spy stuff, and isn't there, like, references to stuff? Like, he was, like, the Jerry Cornelius... The Gideon Stargrave character was based on, like, Jerry Cornelius, and, like, some other books, J.G. Ballard's The Day of Forever, and his series there, and... That's what it seems like to me. It seems like Gideon Stargrave is like their James Bond, like a surrealistic James Bond that he decided to do in this weird sort of universe where the Pope is trying to take over the world and Gideon narrates stuff very eloquently. Like it is like Grant T. Morrison's style is completely different when he's doing this, and I think like I understand where it's coming from. But at the same time, yeah, it's a little strange. It's a little strange.
Yeah, he definitely has some dialogue that's quite humorous. There was one part toward the end where he said, like, oh, it was something like, talk to you, T-T-Y-L, or something like that.
Yeah.
It's at the end of Gideon Stargrave. He says something like, he kills the final guy. I wish I remember what that was. But... Yeah, Gideon Stargrave, he's definitely, like, reining it in a little bit more as compared to the first story of Times of Four-Letter War. And it's, you know, got a lot more space to make sense of it. I enjoyed it. But Checkmate Man, final story.
That's the best one.
I guess. I mean, it seemed like they probably, like, got letters being like, what the fuck am I reading in this magazine? And then they were like, Grant, can you kind of hone it in a little bit? Because it seemed like he was not really writing stories for an audience with the first few. He was just writing stories for himself where, like, he'd be like, yeah, that's right. I referenced, like, all this stuff that no one knows what I'm talking about. You know what I mean?
What, do you think they just paid him, like, ad space or something? You get 6 pages. Now do whatever.
No, I mean, for back in the day, I mean, the artwork, what do you think about his artwork style?
Better as time goes on. Like, I'm still trying to figure out what are the gaps between them. I'm looking, again, at sort of the bibliography of the Near Myth stuff, and it looks like the first one was in 78, but this one, where it ends, Checkmate Man, it's in the 80s. So it's like, he looks like he got, like, as he got older, and he became 20, 21, his skills got refined more. So that's why I feel like Checkmate Man's the best, and technically it's the best, too. I just hate that it ends so abruptly. But, yeah, I liked it. It was really good. Really reminiscent of, like, the old John Byrne stuff. I think I'm trying to place a name to the art.
So the basic story of Checkmate Man is there's a guy who died in a construction accident, I want to say. Something like that. He falls off a building.
Yeah.
And then this scientist rebuilds his body with to be basically a robot, and enables him to jump through time, but the CIA enlists him to kill historical figures in the past that have disrupted the United States power. And so in the beginning of the story, he's killing off, what's his name? Karl Marx?
Yeah.
And then throughout, I think he kills, Mao Zedong?
He kills Mao Zedong, he kills Bobby Kennedy,
Marilyn Monroe.
Does some other stuff, like Watergate and stuff like that. He does, like, pretty much all the bad stuff in the last 3 years of whenever this came out.
Yes. And it, sets it up for, this character. He's trying to, find, he references, George Orwell, and then it's mentioned that he, doesn't have any George Orwell books on his bookshelf anymore. There's, a spot where they used to be. And so, obviously they took him out, too.
I don't know if they took him out. When I think about that scene, looking back on it, I'm thinking maybe because he changed history so much, George Orwell doesn't exist, or, the events of something caused George Orwell to die or not become an author or something. That's what it seems like. Because didn't Cornell, this guy's last name, didn't he get sent to go back in time to kill John Wilkes Booth, but Lincoln still dies?
Yes.
So that's what I was sort of thinking. Some things never change, you know?
Yes. So all in all, if you're interested in early Grant Morrison, I'd say look these up. His most famous series from the beginning is a series called Zenith, but that wasn't his first, so we're not talking about that shit.
But it was probably famous.
Yes. if you want to read about Grant Morrison's early work, there's a book you can get called Grant Morrison, The Early Years, written by a guy named Timothy Callahan, and it has a very goofy, cartoony image of Mr. Grant Morrison on the cover. I guess he couldn't get the rights to get an actual photo of the man.
This was cheaper.
Yeah, so who knows?
What are some other good books that we can mention? More mainstream books of Grant Morrison?
Animal Man? I haven't read it, but I've only heard good things.
That Arkham Asylum thing.
Yes. And if you don't know who Grant Morrison is, he recently, of course, did Final Crisis and Batman RIP, and he's got a series coming up with none other than Frank Quitely, who he did a really good book with.
All-Star Superman.
I was going to say We Three, but yes, that one too. I think We Three was the actual first Grant Morrison thing I ever read, so that kind of got me used. So if you haven't read anything of his, I think that's a good place to start, or at least it was for me personally. And they're talking about doing a movie of it, so I don't know. After the success of Bolt, you never know. It might happen.
Yes. Bolt. I need Way 3. Get me Grant Morrison.
All right, well, you got anything else to say for Grant Morrison's Near Myths work?
Good, but not groundbreaking.
All right, well, moving on. Art's going to talk about Brian Michael Bendis' Fire. Was this book groundbreaking to you?
Yeah. I mean, the enthusiasm was just kind of knocked back because I didn't read Fire first. The only thing is, because I read Goldfish first, and I read Jinx first, and I read Torso, and then, Fire was, fourth. But I think it's good, you know, I think that's the only problem with, some of these books. If you read these first, then I think you'd fall more in love with them, but most people don't really get that opportunity. Most people who are reading Brian Michael Bendis right now are probably reading Dark Avengers or something. They read more mainstream stuff, like Grant Morrison. They haven't had the opportunity to get Near Myths or whatever. So that's what Fire is. Fire is, it's sort of kind of his take on, the Jason Bourne kind of stuff. It's this college kid who becomes, he's not really doing anything, and then, the CIA operative kind of sets him up to be part of this experiment in a covert operations. They're trying to turn a nobody into James Bond. And
his name is Benjamin.
Yes. Old Benjamin.
Benji. The Brian Michael Bendis love for dialogue that's 1 minute really serious and 1 minute and the next minute, goofy as hell, is right here from the beginning. Because in the in the beginning of it, he's getting like tortured by these CIA agents, and then it goes into the past and him hanging out with like one of his college friends, and he starts telling him this story about how he went to a party. I don't know if you remember this part or not, Art. And there's this girl there, and everyone's like starts like being like, yeah, he's like flirting with her, and all of a sudden everyone at the party's like, oh, do that thing you do, and he's the guy's like, what? And all of a sudden she like. Gets out a lighter and farts on it, and
the lights
a huge
her own
flame.
Farts. That's what she does.
Yes, basically lights her farts across the room, and he's like, "Oh, gross! That's disgusting." So what'd you do? And he's like, "Oh, well, I fucked her, of course."
Yeah, rereading this again, it makes me love the long diatribes that Bendis used to do, and I think I always loved that. I mean, he would just take like however many pages. They're usually like. There were at least like 8 to 10 pages usually, where these just long diatribes telling like a story about one of the characters, and I kind of miss that. It kind of sucks, you know, doing like a 22-page mainstream comic book now, and you can't really stretch and do scenes like this anymore. And I think that's what I loved Brian Michael Bendis's take on like his own creations. His black and white stuff I think is probably his best. It's his best stuff, but I think it's most cinematic, because like you can see where he was coming from there, and you can see his art was like, he was done by models, you know, like he hired models, or he got pictures of like his best friends or famous actors or something, and he modeled characters based off of that, and then it's very cinematic, the way shots are lined up and everything. And like I said, I miss this. I miss when you can actually do, I'm trying to remember, we were talking about Nightly News. Nightly News, I think, was Jonathan Hickman's, like, cinematic take. And, like, if you read it all in a collected form, it's great. And then Fire is the same thing. Fire, this was, I think, I'm trying to remember, 1994 Cavalier Comics or something. But now you can get it all collected in sort of a artist cut, director's cut sort of thing.
Remastered edition.
Yeah, this THX, Toby Digital and all that good stuff that Brian Michael Bendis got to fix up an Image in 2001, 2002.
And I think that's the version I have.
Yeah. I think last time I checked, Amazon or eBay or something, like $10 or so. So
yes.
Maybe cheaper. Fingers crossed. So
he went in and like cleaned up in the back of the book. There's a page that kind of shows like now he went back in and did it all with the computer, and some of the like backgrounds are changed a little bit. But with Grant Morrison's work, with the near-miss stuff, it's hard to really critique Grant Morrison because I guess I'm just not smart enough to do it because I don't know.
You don't possess the mental capacity to critique.
Yeah. But with this, there are a couple of critiques. Nothing major. I really did enjoy the story. I enjoyed seeing this college kid get down the, you know, rabbit hole with this whole CIA thing and kind of getting over his head and then try to find his way back out. But it's very dated, like the way the characters look, some of the hairstyles. I mean, you could say the same thing. That would be one complaint about
it's too dated.
Grant Morrison's work. Although one of the characters did remind me of the guy who gets the box. Remember the scene where the guy gets the box to him and he's like, oh, you're just a pawn in the game, kid. Remember that?
No, I don't. But keep going.
It's just like about halfway through. It reminds me of John Goodman's character. Isn't John Goodman in that Coen Brothers movie?
Which one? Barton Fink? Big Lebowski?
Big Lebowski, yeah. But anyway, if you see you'll see the page, I guess.
Yeah, I got it.
That's what I'm talking about. With the beard and tie.
Unless he remastered him in this version. I highly doubt it.
But the ending is the big, like, Watchmen just came out in the theater. Everyone has probably seen it if you're listening to this. You know the ending where Rorschach's journal winds up at the newspaper and the kid is left to decide whether to use it for an article or not. Now, Watchmen came out in what year, the book?
86, I want to say.
And Fire came out in when?
94. Oh, wait, you think he's ripping off? That was the plan?
I'm not saying he's ripping it off. I'm just saying, like, I wish the ending was a little different, because all I could think of it at that ending was, this isn't going to end like Watchmen, is it? And then it pretty much exactly does. I mean, it doesn't wind up at a news. The guy's journal doesn't wind up at a news organization.
No.
But it's just sitting there on the table, and he's trying to figure out what to do, because he's pretty much in between a rock and a hard place, and he's got this journal, and he wants to expose the truth, and then he's going to be killed if he tries to, and so I don't know. Just was too Watchmen reminiscent. And
well,
it's like,
I was talking about that about Joker. Like, I just saw Dark Knight when we read Brian Azzarello's Joker when that thing came out, and it's like, there's obviously similarities there. It's like, I don't know.
They wrote that book like a year before the movie came out.
Yeah, but the movie came out before the book came out. You know, like, you can't really, you know, I understand what you're saying, where you're coming from about that. You know, like, oh, we thought of it first, but they put it out and it's in my brain first.
Yeah, but that was like a matter of months. This was a matter of like a decade. You know what I mean?
It's not really a decade, but yeah. I don't know. Like, where would you take that ending? When I see an ending like that, and I've been seeing a lot of endings lately, Battlestar for one, but like, I'm like, as far as the story goes, like, where could you possibly go in that ending? Like, do you kill the kid? Do you, like, did you want the ending like 20 pages ago? Where he was presumed dead, and then you're just doing one of those backward stories, like certain movies where the character's telling you the story, but he's dead, like American Beauty or something?
I'm not Brian Michael Bendis, so I don't know. Maybe you could have, you know, the Dee Dee, the woman that the kid that Benjamin was all interested in, isn't that her name?
Yes.
You could have him get a sex change to where he looks like Dee Dee.
What's the fucking Crying Game now?
Yes. That would be brilliant.
Mr. Bendis, I got a new ending for you.
The alternate ending of Fire.
For the 20th anniversary.
Benjamin goes drag.
Just put that under. Oh, brilliant. Brilliant stuff.
So yeah, but this paved the way for all of Mr. Bendis' future work. Jinx, Powers, Torso, Daredevil, all that good stuff.
All that stuff we mentioned before.
And any final thoughts for Brian Michael Bendis' Fire art?
Not really so much for Fire, but for near myths, because we're pretty much wrapping up anyway. You know, like, this is better, obviously. This is more linear. I can follow this. I've seen other crime genres before, so it's just like, okay, I got that. But I was just thinking about near myths. Just, you know, I have a whole bunch of quotes, like post-its, hanging up on my wall, just thinking of certain little things to think when I'm thinking of something obscure and something non-linear when I'm reading Grant Morrison stuff. And I always feel like there's one I really like. It's the one that says, like, if this story is told poorly or unexpectedly, there's not a reason to celebrate, but I don't think this is a poorly told story. I think it's an unexpected and weird story told from a weird and unexpected angle. And that's sort of how I feel about the near myths. So it's like, if you're interested in the man, go eBay, get issue 5, because I think that's his best. At least if you're going to at least get one, get that one.
Yeah.
It's half a story, but I mean, I think it's his best work until you get to Zenith.
Okay, I have a question to pose to you.
Yes.
I was actually thinking, because this actually is pretty appropriate for this famous first. I was talking to someone recently about Final Crisis and Secret Invasion 10 years from now. And right off the bat, like, when we were reviewing Secret Invasion, we all pretty much, well, I don't know if you, but we were all, like, enjoying Secret Invasion more instantly because, you know, it's just like, oh, there's Skrulls, heroes that gotta fight them, mm-hmm. bang. Mm-hmm. But Final Crisis, like, what the hell's going on? There's delays, there's art problems, I don't know who these characters are, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I probably will never read Secret Invasion again in my life. Like, I read it once, that's enough. Mm-hmm. Final Crisis, I'm assuming the trade isn't coming out for another few months now. But I'm assuming when it does, they're going to have a lot of the problems from the final few issues fixed, remastered art, etc. Like, 10 years from now, would you look back on Final Crisis as a better story or Secret Invasion now that they're both behind us?
Well, we never had the debate. Debate that we're supposed to have. Well, not supposed to, but, like, we never really got into, like, which one's better than others. And, like, all three of us, you know, Jesse included. And so, as we were reading it, and the delays and stuff is always a bitch for Final Crisis, but I always felt the Final Crisis was, like my quote said, I felt like it's just a different tale, like, that we're not used to seeing. It was just, like, we're trying to look at this in different eyes or something. Well, Secret Invasion was just kind of a cliched story that kind of fell apart for me personally in, like, issue 5, where I was confused about the glance and stuff. To answer your question, I was just thinking Final Crisis is going to be better if they actually do it right and they actually get everything collected and not just the 7 issues or something. Because I was looking at the upcoming trade for the specs of that, and it just looks like, personally, it's going to be those 7 issues plus the Superman Beyond stuff, where he actually fights that crazy vampire thingy. And that's about it. Yeah. It
came out of nowhere.
Yeah. And that's about it. It's not going to be everything, which kind of sucks to me. Like, and I always wondered about that. Like, are they going to do that with Secret Invasion 2? Or it's just, no, it's just the short-contained story. But anyway, yeah, I feel that Final Crisis is going to be better because Final Crisis, Grant Morrison tried to do something. He tried to do something different. You know, like, I mean, you can frame it in, like, the foundation that, oh, that's a big holy shit thing that they've done before, you know, the Infinite Crisis on Infinite Earths. You can just point your fingers to when, like, all the characters of a particular universe has to fight a supervillain or whatever. But at least he did something different with it.
Yeah.
That's what I have to give Grant Morrison for. Brian Michael Bendis, this is, like, you knew it was going to happen. So that's why I kind of... That's the ultimate slam.
It seems to me like Grant Morrison, like, especially reading this early work, I'm not an aficionado of Grant Morrison, I'm not going to pretend to be, but I had read about how many things, like, he had planted seeds for Final Crisis and all the characters from Seven Soldiers and all that. It, like, his entire career, like, even some of this Near Myth stuff was reminding me of Final Crisis, had led up to telling that story. And with Brian Michael Bendis, like, I mean, the dialogue's still there. You know, he has that signature dialogue, but, like, that's not when you, like, I think when Bendis looks back on his career, he's not going to be like, Secret Invasion, that's the story I'm the most proud of telling. You know what I mean?
Yeah. To me, when I always look back at that, it was like, who had more free reign? And you can obviously tell Grant Morrison did. Like you just said right there, every bit of work that Grant Morrison has been doing since he started was leading up to Final Crisis in one form or another. But when you look at Secret Invasion, that was just like...
I mean, yeah, he had planted seeds with the Skrulls and all that, but I mean...
Not really. I mean, he did, but he didn't... Like when I hear the backstory behind that, and I always hear, like, oh... Like, somewhere, it was either 3 or 5 years he's been planning the Secret Invasion. I'm like, I didn't see it. I didn't see it at all. So, but based on that logic, the whole, I've been planning this for 5 years, like, shouldn't they have already taken over the world then? They should have secretly been in every level of government and politics and everything.
Well, there was that big 2-page spread of fucking celebrities and whatnot.
Yeah, but... You know, my argument for that is always like, then why the fuck are you invading as actual Skrulls? Like, why would you give that away? It's, you know, it's like, there was like...
Why do the Cylons still use the robots, and that, why aren't they all just skin jobs?
Because why would they waste the robots?
I don't know enough about Skrull technology. Maybe they all, like, can't transform to a human... Maybe, I don't know.
No, they all could transform. So it was like, if to me, it was just like, if you were going to do an old school humans versus aliens tale, I'd been okay with that. But you didn't. You did, you had sleeper agents or whatever infiltrate superhero organizations to dissuade the superheroes. And, you know, like, and they had a whole bunch of other plans we can get into after. But that was my problem. Like, it just kind of fell apart.
Well, so basically what we're saying, I think we're both kind of hitting on the same point, is that Bendis's early work is like something, it's kind of like Ed Brubaker's Crime. It's like, or when, what's his name? Preacher, what's that guy? He does the war stories.
Yeah.
Garth Ennis does the, it's like
that,
you
that's
can
his
tell
niche.
He's working
that is his
in
niche.
His elements.
That, yes, that is it. Like, when Bendis does Crime, I think he's a genius. Like, it raises the bar. When Bendis does superhero stuff, it gets kind of cliche, and I think that's the problem. Grant Morrison has always been doing his sort of thing and just kind of raising the bar on everything he does, every genre he does. It's something different, and that's the difference between the two.
Well, I agree. So that about wraps it up, I believe, for this installment of Famous Firsts. If you want to check out more podcasts, sidecasts, and all that good stuff, go to breakthefourthwall.com. You can subscribe via iTunes, be our friend at MySpace at myspace.com/fourthwallpodcast. And if you want to send us an email about how we can't describe Grant Morrison's brilliance in articulately enough, do so at
contactfourthwall@yahoo.com.
Yes. And would you like to tell them what's coming up next month for Famous First, number 5? Or do you remember?
Mark Miller.
Oh, yeah.
And...
What doesn't go with Mark Miller at all?
Jelly.
Neil Gaiman.
It's not PB&J. It's... I don't know what it is.
In our continuing tradition of putting together two authors who really don't go together.
Not at all.
Or two works, I guess I should say. Because some of the authors, I guess, kind of go together. Like Ed Brubaker, Warren Ellis, or...
Yeah.
Anyway, so stay tuned for that. That's going to be May 1st, so look out for that. And the books, if you don't already know, Violent Cases is going to be Neil Gaiman's, and Savior / Chosen, because they're essentially the same story by Mark Miller. Teenage boy finds out, oops, I'm Jesus.
It sounds like it could be a sitcom.
Oops, I'm Jesus.
Oops, I'm Jesus. It's filmed by a live studio audience.
All right, well, stay tuned. So I'm Freddie.
And I'm Mark.
Peace
out.
Darling,